Good evening, and I'm very, very grateful that so many people have stayed behind at 6:30. If I do this talk at 6:30 in Australia, it will probably be me, the chair, and the next speaker. So I'm very, very grateful that also so many of you stayed behind so late on a Friday night. So it's my job today to talk about some of the controversies on pleural infections and some of the recent advances. This is a very common clinical scenario, 25-year-old man admitted with pneumococcal pneumonia. He has 3 days of intravenous antibiotics, discharged home, come back a week later with high fever, and as you can see, he's got a large pleural effusion. On the CT scan, he's got consolidation, pleural effusion, and a ring of pleural enhancement, and aspiration of the pleural fluid shows frank pus, confirming that this is an empyema. As I mentioned, Hippocrates was probably one of the first pleural disease experts. And in his days, he described pleural empyema. But since that time, we have better nutrition, we have better living environment, broad-spectrum antibiotics, pleural drainage techniques, vaccines for pneumonia, and supportive care. But not only have we failed to eradicate empyema, the incidence of pleural infection has been shown to be rising around the world and in all age groups. This is a review article that we published back in 2011, and these are the places which has published data that the regional or national incidence of pleural infection are still rising. And since then, there's been more papers from Scandinavia and the United States as well. This is a very interesting paper from the state of Utah, which kept very good record of the incidence of deaths from pleural infection back from 1900 right through to 2000 to 2005. As you can see, the incidence was very, very high, especially during the Spanish flu seasons. And then since the introduction of penicillin, the incidence of mortality from empyema has dropped very, very low, only to restart and has a re-emergence of the incidence of empyema death in the last 5 years of this study. This is the largest study that looks at the incidence of pleural infection in patients with community-acquired pneumonia. More than 4,500 people from Spain. Based on chest x-ray, about 1 in 5 will have a pleural effusion. 14 out of those 19% turn out to have simple parapneumonic effusion, and about 5% will have an empyema or complicated parapneumonic effusion. The severity scores of pneumonia, like KERB-65 and PSI, did not actually predict empyema. Likewise, the predictors of empyema and complicated effusions in the community-acquired pneumonia patients differ from the proven risk factors of poor outcomes in pneumonia. So pneumonia and pleural infection seems to be two slightly separate processes. These are the two largest studies that looks at the risk factor of patients with pneumonia that develops pleural effusions. So on the left-hand side is a Spanish study, 4,500 patients. On the right-hand side, a UK study, about 1,300 patients. Both of them identified alcoholism plus or minus IV drug use as a risk factor. Those who have high inflammatory indices, such as white cell count or C-reactive protein, has much higher incidence of pleural effusions. Those who have pruritic chest pain, tachycardia, and younger age seems to have a higher incidence as well. As I mentioned this morning, this is how we think pleural infections develops. When you have pneumonia, usually most of the patients don't have a pleural effusion. But about 40 to 50% will have on ultrasound a simple parapneumonic effusion. About 10% of those develop complicated parapneumonic effusions, and at the extreme end are the empyema, which are the patients who have frank pus or bacteria isolated by Gram stain or culture. And as I mentioned, we draw the line nowadays to group together complicated parapneumonic effusions and empyema as pleural infection. So when you read our papers and we talk about pleural infection, it refers to this combined group. There are three main controversies in pleural infections: the role of surgery, the size of the chest tube you need to put in, and the role of intrapleural fibrinolytics. So I'm going to ask you to raise your hand. There's no right or wrong to these answers. and just to see what is the common practice in your unit. So the first is, if you see a patient with empyema, how many of you will send the patient straight to surgery? How many of you will use surgery as a last resort? So hands up, how many of you will send the patient to surgery as soon as possible? And how many of you will send the patients only as a last resort to surgery after you tried everything else? So half and half. So already in Lebanon, you are behaving exactly like the rest of the world, and very split about the differences between the two options. If you see a patient with pleural infections today, how many of you, hands up, how many of you will have to put in a large bore tube, more than 20 French gauge? How many of you will put in a small size tubes, 16 French gauge or below? So once again, 50-50. But I'm going to change this question slightly. If you develop a pleural infection today, and you want me to put in a chest tube, how many of you want me to put in a large tube? How many of you wants to have a small tube? So about half of you change your mind when it becomes you, not your patient. So in patients with pleural infections, how many of you will give fibrinolytics? Never. How many of you sometimes will give fibrinolytics? How many of you will more often than not give fibrinolytics? So once again, a very widespread. So these three points are the most controversial points in the pleural infection management. This is Sir William Mosler, father of modern medicine. Not many of you know that he actually suffered from an empyema, at which time he said, "Empyema needs a surgeon and 3 inches of cold steel instead of the fool of a chest physician." So unfortunately, he died from his empyema despite having radical surgery and rib resection after a very prolonged course of over 9 months. On the other hand, this is Dr. Dupuytren. He was Napoleon's surgeon. He also had empyema. He said, "I rather died at the hands of God than the hands of the surgeons." So very wise, but he also died from his empyema within a couple of weeks. So to drain or not to drain, and how best to drain, has been the important questions that has been the topic of debates for many centuries. The principles of management of pleural infection is very simple. You need to control the infection and the sepsis, usually with antibiotics. You need to remove as much as you can the pleural infective collections, which is usually through a chest tube to drain the pus, and then to break down the adhesions. And it may be through fibrinolytics, it may be through surgery. So the principles are simple, but the actual execution is sometimes a lot more complicated. The first take-home message for today is that the majority of pleural infections can be cured with antibiotics and chest tube drainage without requiring surgery. These are the two largest randomized studies ever performed in pleural infection, the multi-center intrapleural sepsis trial 1 and trial 2. They all have a control group which has chest tube and antibiotics and just saline flushes. And in the control group, in MIST 1, 73% of them were successfully treated. And 84% in the MIST 2 were successfully treated in the control group, which means that most of the patients can be successfully treated with antibiotics and chest tube alone. This is not pleural infection, and you can recognize that this is pneumothorax. This is a patient with primary spontaneous pneumothorax. Why am I showing you this? Because we all know that surgery is a good definitive treatment for pneumothorax, but we also know that we don't put every patient through VATS surgery at the first instance of pneumothorax. Because we know that chest tube drainage is adequate and about 70% of them will not have a recurrence. So if you apply that same principle to empyema, we know that chest tube drainage and antibiotics has a success rate of 70 to 80%. So why should we actually send all the patients to surgery? So routine VATS surgery as a first-line treatment is not quite justified. There has been 4 randomized studies comparing surgery as a first-line versus surgery as a last resort. 2 of them in pediatric setting, 2 of them in adult setting. Of the 2 pediatric trials, they saw very similar results, and I chose to show you the Great Ormond Street one, which is more commonly cited. So patients were randomized to have VATS surgery right away or chest tube with urokinase. It showed no difference in mortality, no difference in hospital days, no difference in post-operative days, no difference in x-ray clearance. Surgeons are always overpaid, so it is more expensive to do that surgery. Two adult trials, randomized studies. One is a very small study of only 19 patients in the United States. One is a Turkish study from 70 patients. Both of them comparing surgery as first line versus chest tube plus streptokinase or without streptokinase. No difference in mortality, no difference in cost. It did in both study, both shows that there was a slightly improved length of stay for hospital stays. But that is the only advantage of surgery as first line. Although I said that the majority of the patients can be cured with antibiotics and chest drain, you have to do those two things properly, which means that you have to use the appropriate antibiotics and you have to put in the chest tube in the right place. The size does not matter, the site matters, and imaging guidance is quite important these days. As I showed you this morning, this is the missed one data of 450 patients, 80% has purulent pus in their chest, 40% of them never culture any organisms. So as we mentioned this morning, if you start putting your pleural fluid into the blood culture bottles, you will increase your yield from around 40% to 60%, which is a 50% increase. But the important thing is to know which bacteria is more common. Just like we differentiate pneumonia into community-acquired and hospital-acquired, we need to differentiate empyema into community-acquired empyema and hospital-acquired empyema. We know from the UK data 50% of patients with hospital-acquired empyema were treated with inappropriate antibiotics, at least at the beginning. And we know that hospital-acquired empyema have significantly worse prognosis. This is UK data. Most common organism in community-acquired empyema is Strep milleride, followed by pneumococci. Together, they account for about half of all the community empyema, but it accounts for less than 10% of hospital-acquired cases. On the other hand, MRSA and enterococci accounts for more than 50% of the hospital-acquired empyema, but are extremely rare in community cases. So you can see that they are very different bacteriology between the two, and you need to differentiate between community versus hospital-acquired pleural infections. I'm not going to tell you which antibiotics to use, because the bacteriology in each country or region can vary quite significantly. What I've shown you is the UK data, the Australian data is different, and you need to know what is the Lebanon data to guide you what is the appropriate antibiotics. This is an MRI picture of a patient with empyema. On the T1 imaging, you can see pleural effusion, and then you can see the pleural enhancement of pleural thickening. On the T2 imaging, you can see beautiful delineation of the septation, and you can see how loculated it is inside and why pus is sometimes very difficult to come out of the chest drains. So do larger drains, do fibrinolytics or surgery help to get rid of these loculations? First of all, we need to know what is chest drain size. Maybe not all of you know what chest drain size actually means. One French gauge is 1/3 of a millimeter. But it is very important to recognize that when you put in a chest tube, the French gauge refers to the external diameter. But the actual internal diameter can vary a lot, depends on the material used and how thick is the wall of that drain, and it differs between manufacturers. This is a very elegant study published in the Radiology Journal by a Korean group. It measures the number of seconds by which fluid goes from one end of the chest tube to the other. And on the x-axis is the chest drain size of the internal diameter. So when they put water down from the chest tube from one end to the other, it runs down very quickly. When they put serosanguinous exudative pleural effusion, it takes a bit longer. It takes a bit longer further if they put in blood. And this is pus by itself, and this is pus with urokinase. But you can see that when it reaches about 12 French gauge external diameter, which is 8.5 French gauge internal diameter, and certainly by the time you get to 18 French gauge external diameter, there's really no difference in the drainage speed. So any larger size, bigger than 18 French gauge, is not necessary from that point of view. You need to know that there has never been any randomized study to support the use of bigger drains. This is as good a study as we have got at the moment. This is not randomized. This is the MIS-1 data, where they allowed the treating physician to decide whether the patient should have small bore tubes or large bore tubes. By small bore, I mean 16 French gauge or below. And you can see already in the UK, if you allow the chest physician to choose, the majority of them choose to use small bore tubes, compared with about one-third who use large bore tubes. These patients are sick with very purulent secretions, and you find that the outcome is no difference. 15% in the small bore tube ended up requiring surgery, compared with 17% that requires surgery in the large bore tube. So my second important message, if you can only remember one thing of all the four talks I'm going to do this weekend, I want you to remember this point. That provided the infection settles, the residual pleural opacity will resolve with time. All around the world, every day, surgery is being done unnecessarily to clear residual pleural collections when the patient is clinically improved. This is the only point, if you're going to remember only one point from my talks this weekend, this is the point. And I'll show you why. There has been two studies, one from South Africa and one from Oxford, showing that if you have treated the infection, then over time the lung function and the residual X-ray changes will improve spontaneously. This is the percentage of the X-ray covered by pleural opacity in the patients that were admitted to hospital. At the time of admission in this study from Cape Town, about more than 50% of the hemithorax is covered by pleural opacity. By the time of discharge, 25%. By the time of 3 months, 5 or 10%. By the time of 6 months, only 5%. And the FVC improves accordingly. I want you to remember that pleural infection is a bit like lung infection. Residue changes will settle with time, provided that the infection is controlled. So on this X-ray, this patient doesn't have empyema. He's got a right upper lobe pneumonia. I'm sure you know that. I treated him with antibiotics. His fever and his C-reactive protein settled. But he still, at day 4, had this nasty chest X-ray, which has not improved. So what are you going to do? How many of you will say you need to send him to lobectomy because the chest X-ray is not improved? Hands up, how many of you will send him to lobectomy? Of course not. What you will do is reassure him that the chest X-ray changes will settle with time. You will send him home with antibiotics and ask him to come back in 3 or 4 weeks and have a repeat X-ray, which looks like this. If you have sent him to lobectomy, it would have been a crime. But every day around the world, people are committing similar crimes when it comes to pleural infections. This is an 18-year-old with pleural infection after she has sepsis from post-appendixectomy. She's got a very loculated effusion. You can actually see that there's two separate chest drains. Her fever and C-reactive protein has settled with antibiotics. They're normalized, but she still has this nasty-looking chest X-ray. Our thoracic surgeon was happy to take her to theater, but I was consulted, and I said, no, we don't need to do anything. We apply the same principle. We reassure her that the chest X-ray changes will settle with time. I took all the chest tube out and sent him home on antibiotics. This is 1 week later. This is 2 weeks later, and at 4 weeks, it's all normal. So treat the patient, do not treat the X-ray. If your surgeon is not happy with it, put another chest tube in the surgeon's chest, not the patient. The patient doesn't require it. What if this infection persists despite optimal antibiotics and chest drain? It will occur. As I show you in MIS-1 and MIS-2, there are about 20% or 30% of patients, despite you doing everything right that I've just said, will still have a persistent infection. So streptokinase has been used, and has been used in two randomized studies. One is Nick Maskell's study, a randomized multicenter study from the UK, and one is Andreas Diakon, single-center study from Cape Town. Both of them have shown exactly the same result, that streptokinase kinase has no benefit over placebo, which is saline, in terms of avoiding death or surgery. 15% of the patients in the placebo group require surgery, 16% in the streptokinase kinase group. 14% in the placebo group died, 16% in the streptokinase kinase group died. Why did standard therapy fail? We think that there are two major obstacles to effective drainage. One is the fibrin acceptations and loculations that we have shown you before. This is clearly a loculated effusion because the fluid does not sink down as gravity should have dictated. And after drainage, you still have loculated effusion. The second reason is because pus is thick. Pus is thick because of degranulated white blood cells and the release of the DNA from the white blood cells. So theoretically, if we use a fibrinolytic to break down those adhesions and to use DNAs, which is palmacyme, which in the Western world doctors have been using for a long time to use for cystic fibrosis patients to thin the sputum, then we can potentially also thin the pus. So the combination of TPA and DNAs should have synergistic effect to improve the pleural fluid drainage. And that has been tested in animal studies and ex vivo studies to show that it works. So that formed the basis of our multicenter intrapleural sepsis trial 2, which was a factorial trial randomizing patients with pleural infection to DNAs by itself, TPA by itself, DNAs plus TPA, or placebo with placebo. And the result was published about 18 months ago in the New England Journal. If you use a magnifying glass, you'll find my name somewhere in that middle. What we found was that the use of combination TPA and DNAs significantly improved the outcomes. Now, the primary outcome was radiographic improvement at day 7. So this is the percentage of the hemiforex covered by pleural opacity. So 0 means no change at day 7. Negative 100% means that the whole X-ray is cleared. And anything above 0 means that the X-ray got worse. So if you look at the placebo group, chest tube drainage and antibiotics clears about 30% of the pleural opacity. TPA by itself, about the same. DNAs by itself, about the same. It's only when you use TPA plus DNAs that you get twice the improvement. But as I said to you before, radiographic improvement is not the most important issue. Is whether the patient got better. This is a randomized trial, so the clinicians doesn't know what drug the patient was getting. But despite that, only 16% of the patients in the placebo group require surgery, but only 4% in the TPA and DNAs group actually was referred to surgery. So in other words, using TPA and DNAs, you can cure about 96% of all the empyemas without requiring surgery. It's important that it is not just TPA, it is not just DNAs. In fact, DNAs by itself makes the patient worse. It's the combination treatment. And the hospital stay was 6.7 days shorter in the TPA and DNAs group compared with placebo. This is a typical example, patient of mine, MRSA empyema. Very loculated effusion emitted in day 1. We put in a chest tube, overnight only 100 cc came out, no improvement on the X-ray. So 3 days of TPA and DNAs, and you can see it's complete clearance of the pleural opacity with some residual mnemonic changes. In the MIS 2, we gave people who come through the door, newly diagnosed, to have empyema, TPA and DNAs for all patients. But we also know in the placebo group, about 84% were treated successfully with antibiotics and chest drains. So we asked the question, should TPA and DNAs be used for everybody right at day 1, or should we reserve them as rescue therapy when the patient is not improving? So this is the largest open label series on TPA and DNAs that we are about to submit to publication. We have treated about 107 patients. They all have pleural infections. They all received antibiotics and chest tube, but were not improving. These patients are sick. 107 patients, 70% male and 57 years old. 70% of them has more than one significant comorbidities. And pH is 6.9, LDH 1700, half of them have frank pus, 90% has got Peru effusion, which are loculated on ultrasound. So these are sick patients who has failed to improve with initial chest tube and antibiotics. But despite that, we still managed to successfully treat 93% of these patients. By successfully treated, I mean that they survived the infection, they did not require surgery, the x-ray looks better, and the inflammatory markers improved, and they were discharged home. The median hospital stay was 10 days from the first dose. This is the dot plot of the amount of fluid that they drained. So tPA and DNAs increased the peripheral fluid drainage. On the 24 hours before we give them tPA and DNAs, the median drainage is 250 cc's. At 24 hours after the first dose, 1.3 liters. By 72 hours, cumulative total was 2.5 liters. So tPA and DNA certainly improved drainage. It also reduced the effusion size. This is the percentage of the X-ray of the hemithorax that is covered by pleural opacity, and it decreases from about 35%, such as this X-ray, to 13%, such as this patient. It also has a significant reduction of inflammatory markers. So if you set the CRP as 100% at day one, then by day five, the median CRP is 50%. Only 8 of those 107 patients require surgery because of persistent infection, and all survive without complications. 3 patients died, but they didn't die from Peru infection. They died from the underlying problems of end-stage renal failure and metastatic cancer. This is the typical drainage after your first dose of tPA and DNAs. I gave some talks in Johns Hopkins at the beginning of this year, and they were very scared after using it for the first patient, because this was what comes out of the patient's chest the next day. This is entirely typical of using fibrinolytics. This is not something that you need to worry about. However, you need to monitor the patients for bleeding, but you only need to do anything if the hematocrit or hemoglobin actually drops. And that in our series of 107 patients has only occurred twice. Both of those patients has got underlying risk factors. One has got liver cirrhosis, one was actually on full dose of anticoagulation for pulmonary emboli. And pain, however, is quite common, usually in the first dose, and about 1 in 4, 1 in 5 patients require escalation of analgesias. So just to summarize how we should manage patients with Peru infection in the year 2014. Antibiotics and chest tube drainage remains the most important principle. If they are multiloculated, you might need more than one drain, and it might need to be imaging guided. If the infections, that is the fever and inflammatory markers, is not settled despite optimal antibiotics and drainage, consider intrapural tPA and DNAs, such as this patient. And you can see 6 doses later, completely cleared, at follow-up, normalized. But there will be a small number of patients that will still require surgery. That's about less than 5% of those treated with tPA or DNAs. But the most common reasons why we send people for surgery now is bronchopleural fistula, which means that you can't use intrapleural therapy if you have a patient with bronchopleural fistula, because they will just cough it up. This is Anna Pavlova, the famous ballerina, who developed empyema while she was on tour in Den Haag. She was told that if she go and have surgery for her empyema, she will never be able to dance again. But if she comes to my unit today, we have a 96% chance of curing her with tPA and DNAs. She will not require surgery, she will survive the infection, and she will still be able to dance. Thank you very much for your attention.